This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, we'll look at the economic damage that the novel coronavirus has done on the individual level and what one economist says is the most important short-term response.
This is the time to write unconditional checks.
Plus, past experiments with a universal basic income.
The big concern everybody had at the time was, you know, if you give people money for nothing, why won't they just quit their jobs?
And in this era of lockdowns and very close quarters, we'll ask a psychologist whether familiarity really breeds contempt. And if so, what to do about it.
You know, I think the most important thing is to have humility. Humility is recognizing that you could be incomplete or wrong. Very hard to do.
It's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. Ed Glaser is an economist who teaches at Harvard.
There are wonderful things about being proximity to other human beings. We learn from other human beings. We can work with them. But there are also demons that come with density. And the worst of these demons is contagious disease.
Glaser studies a lot of economic issues, but he's got one particular obsession.
My whole life's work has been trying to understand cities and how they work and how they sometimes fail to work.
In 2011, he published a book called Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention, how our greatest invention makes us richer, smarter, greener, healthier, and happier. But in the age of COVID-19, cities also have the capacity to make us sicker.
As the time that we're talking, New York is responsible for almost a third of the total cases in America. So it certainly seems as if density is continuing to do its worst. If you look back historically, these things have been rocking cities for millennia, right? We think about the plague of Athens, 430 BC. We think about the plague of Justinian, which almost 1,000 years later hit Constantinople. If you look at sort of the entire European medieval period, there's a sense in which cities are not particularly safe places. As late as the time of Shakespeare's London, you've got a 6-year life expectancy loss by living in London relative to the rest of England. That was, by the way, still true in New York City in 1900.
And what's going on in cities to create this danger?
There are two things going on, one of which are the cities are connected globally, and secondly, the cities are dense when you get to them. And so the cities are the ports of entry for the new disease, whether it's the rats carrying the fleas or a traveler from Wuhan carrying the virus.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we have now the largest percentage of the human population in history in urban areas. Is that right?
Certainly.
So we have had, you know, earlier spikes in urbanization followed by huge declines. I mean, I'm going way back to the large cities of Mesopotamia and Egypt and so on. Are you worried that COVID-19 and the role that urbanization may play in its spread will turn the tide against your beloved cities?
Of course. And even worse, I'm worried that it should turn the tide against my beloved cities, right? I mean, it's not as if I sit here during COVID-19 and say the important thing is to continue making the case for urban life. I mean, these demons that come with density are very real. Historically, effective governments have always been able to tame them, although sometimes it took many decades to make that possible. I have at least the hope that an effective government can contain the pandemics of the future. If we had managed to lock it in China earlier, if we had managed to get more research on vaccines of this nature earlier. So I tend to be an optimist if we can manage to get effective enough governments. I mean, 150 years ago, cities were universally killing fields. And for most of my life, they most certainly have not been. And that, of course, required massive amounts of public investment. America's cities and towns were spending as much on clean water at the start of the 20th century as the federal government was spending on everything except for the post office and the army. But it was something that we managed to do. I guess I remain hopeful that we can continue to do it. But let's not ignore the fact that pandemic is an existential threat to high-density living based around face-to-face contact.
So it's relatively early days in the pandemic, at least in the U.S., and we don't know what the damage will look like in terms of loss in life, but the economic damage is already coming into view suddenly and intensely. So I'd like to hear your thinking on that, especially the economic damage to individuals and families. That damage is not going to be evenly distributed, is it?
You're exactly right. So if either you have substantial assets or you have a large, highly stable employer, your financial worries during this shutdown are really relatively small. Now, if you're, you know, living hand to mouth and your employer just shut down, and all of a sudden, you've got no income coming in, and if you've got a couple of kids to pay for as well, and you can't just move into your parents' house because maybe they're on the other side of the country, or maybe they're in a nursing home, and then you're looking at just an absolutely terrifying world.
How can you compare this situation to past economic calamities, whether it's pandemics or wars or financial collapses?
I mean, the last sort of pandemic of this scale is really 1919, the influenza, which occurred at the same time as a Great Recession. I don't know that we've ever sorted out what role that pandemic played in creating the recession. There were many other things that were going on. When you think of the fact that one-fifth of the American labor force is in retail, trade, leisure, and hospitality, those are the sectors that are absolutely on this front line. So I could easily imagine that we start seeing, you know, joblessness numbers that look a lot more like the Great Depression than anything that we've seen beforehand. These jobs are ones which, you know, seemed like they were the future. Now, what if all of a sudden we're terrified of face-to-face interactions? Where do those jobs go to? And while there may be a few jobs in delivering the Amazon grocery products that we then turn to, that's a trickle of what we had in the 32 million Americans who work in these big industries. And if this is a permanent shift away from the face-to-face economy, it's one that will have catastrophic impacts on those Americans with less formal schooling.
Okay, I would like you to walk us through quickly what you see the current aid package, federal aid package, looking like. It seems that there's a fundamental choice to make, which is, are you going to help from the top down, meaning fund the firms in the industries that are most in trouble, and hopefully they will take care of their employees and customers, or you're going to fund from the bottom up individuals?
So most of the time, I am not a fan of universal basic income. You know, 6 months ago, 2 months ago, my view was that it was crucial to get more Americans working. Income inequality bothered me much less than the rise of prime age male joblessness. The fact that, you know, when I was born 52 years ago, only less than 1 in 20 prime age males were jobless. For most of the last 15 years, more than 3 in 20 prime age males have been jobless. I think of this as being sort of an absolutely catastrophic thing for America. And so that's where I was before COVID-19. Now, all of a sudden, COVID-19 strikes us, and none of that applies. In the case of the financial crisis or any sort of normal recession, what you're trying to do is shore up the financial system and then make sure people are still spending, make sure people are still working, make sure that the economic system functions as well as it possibly can. During a pandemic, that's not what you're trying to do at all. What you're trying to do is you're trying to make sure everyone goes home. We don't care if nobody's working. We want those people to be, you know, at home. And so this is the time to write people checks. And you're not writing people checks the way that you would be during a standard recession with the idea that this is going to gin up some stimulus and make sure the dollars flow through the system. That's not why you're doing it. You're just insuring them. You're making sure that the mom who worked as a waitress, who has a couple of kids at home, and who has no idea if she's ever getting her job back, you're just making sure that she can put food on the table. If you're going to ask yourself what you're going to do to eliminate, you know, the short-run suffering, let's ensure those Americans whose jobs have vanished for the foreseeable future. And this is the time to write unconditional checks. Now, there's a question as to why make it unconditional. I think my preferred model is one in which everyone gets the checks, but let's say you come around to next year's tax season. If you're earning more than $200,000 and you spent that check, you're going to pay 100% tax on that check. If you're earning between $1,000 and $200K, you're going to spend 50%. But if your earnings are less than $100K, then the money's free and clear.
And why would you do it that way instead of withholding checks now from anyone earning $200K or more?
I just don't want anyone to think about it. I just want the money to get out. Just get it out right now. Let's sort it out when we aren't all terrified of a pandemic. Let's sort it out later. One thing that is clear is that just the experience between rich and poor during this pandemic seems to me even more unequal than the usual experience gap between rich and poor. So I think in some sense, this is just an order of magnitude more terrifying at the low end of the income distribution than at the high end of the income distribution. I believe very strongly in relief right now, policies that stop economic Armageddon from spiraling out of control. So having some sort of a moratorium on foreclosures is perfectly sensible. Doing a few things that would slow down any sort of bankruptcy proceedings for any particular companies is probably the right thing.
Let's talk about Italy for a minute. Let's start with the history of the quarantine.
So as far as I know, this is a Venetian response to the Black Death. They're forcing boats or people, in some cases, to stay for 40 days, hence 40. And it's an attempt to sort of stop the disease from entering into the area. And so you really do need a state that is strong enough to actually enforce these types of quarantines for them to be effective. And I think that's one of the things when you look at, let's say, the modern Italian experience versus the modern Chinese experience, that the Chinese government is just much more effective at imposing a lockdown or a quarantine than its modern Italian equivalents would be.
Other than the virtues of a more authoritarian government to dictate a quarantine, other than that, why do you think the Italian situation has gotten so much worse than really anywhere at this moment?
I was struck by the number of people who were cheating in some ways. They weren't cheating is maybe too strong, but they were still shaking hands, you know, they weren't doing proper masks, they weren't following the quarantines. There's a sense in which, you know, many Italians are skeptical about orders given by their government. There's not necessarily a strong cultural norm of following them, perhaps for good reason, but certainly that makes things harder. And whereas in many cases it's right to, you know, ignore nonsensical orders from the government, during a pandemic, having a government that you trust is really valuable.
So with COVID-19, there's potentially a critical shortage of hospital beds and equipment. Now, in the U.S. at least, governments are typically not very involved in healthcare facilities the way they are in schools and police and fire departments and transportation and so on. And I'm curious whether you think that may be a shortcoming, a blessing, and whether this pandemic may change the way we think about the relationship between government and hospitals.
So it's interesting. Historically, the line was often quite blurry, as it was with universities, right? And they have certainly evolved to be a clear distinction between public and private, where the public hospitals, they have to take the poorer patients, they have to take emergency rooms, and whereas the non-for-profit private hospitals have evolved, in one economist's words, into something more like doctors' cooperatives. So I think there's a lot to like about that system, but of course there are larger issues as well. No individual hospital is set up to deal with the catastrophic risk of a pandemic. But I think there's a good case to be made that whoever we decide is going to be the U.S.'s chief pandemic officer going forward, and I think there's a reasonable view for having a pandemic czar in the country after this, such a person would want to think about how it is that you're going to actually deliver a lot more capacity to hospitals, because I think it's very unlikely that any individual hospital is going to do it, because you're trying to deal with 50 different things every day that are painful, excruciating, but you are not set up to think about how am I going to deal with if all of a sudden a once-in-a-generation pandemic shows up.
If we were to compare military preparedness and the dollars connected to that with pandemic preparedness and the dollars connected with that, my guess is that it would be an incalculably large spread. Now that we've actually got a pandemic that threatens to really attack the root of modern economic and civil society, does this seem like terribly short-sighted planning, or does this seem like, well, the world throws things at you and you have to adjust, and adjust we shall now?
I mean, I certainly agree with the spirit of your question. I mean, I think there were enough warning signs, SARS 17 years ago, swine flu 2009, MERS 8 years ago, Ebola over the years. There were more than enough warning signs that something like this was a real possibility. And if we had had any ability to look forward to this, we should have been spending radically more money than we're spending. So the comparison to military spending is apt, but it also makes sense to compare our spending on pandemic preparedness with our spending on routine medical expenditures, with our spending on Medicare. We as a nation do not underspend on healthcare. We spend an enormous amount of money on healthcare. But what we spend on are the sort of routine medical business of the country. We're set up to do that. We're not set up to spend money for the risk that hasn't happened, for the pandemic that hasn't shown up. And I think that's the crucial thing going forward, is that we need to recognize that this thing has the capacity to do trillions and trillions of dollars of damage. And so it's worthwhile spending at least billions and billions of dollars to actually protect ourselves, to mitigate future risks.
With all the changes that are happening right now in response to COVID-19, a lot more remote working, a lot more remote education, a lot of people considering if all the things that they've done on a daily basis, kind of as habit, are really so valuable. I can imagine all kinds of, you know, shifting of supply and demand in real estate, among other things, if more people are working from home and so on. So I'm just curious if you look down the line at any possible silver linings that you see.
So it depends a little about whether or not you think that currently we're all making a bunch of mistakes about interacting with each other or traveling. And if you think that we're making a lot of mistakes, then we might realize those things are mistakes. I think for some of us, maybe it will teach us to prune some of the unnecessary trips in our lives. That's good. I think there is a sense in which if I think that there's a single political dividend, this certainly reminds us that having a really functional public sector is really valuable. That in fact, you don't actually just want a government that's about, you know, taking from one group and giving to the other. There are actually real jobs for government, like preventing pandemics. And, you know, you really want a government that is actually capable of doing that. And to the extent to which voters in this election, and I'm not saying where that should lead them and who they vote for, but to the extent to which voters realize that actually it's really not about which person you think is being on your team, but it's really about who's going to do the most capable job of producing a government that can actually protect all of America, that would be a really salutary outcome.
So many of the recent viral outbreaks and pandemics, maybe all of them, have originated in non-human species, non-human animals. And there's a pretty strong argument that without the environmental destruction that's a product of capitalism, that this would be happening much less, if at all. That it, you know, that's what's driving these animal-borne diseases and pandemics. So I'm curious, you are, at least according to my reading, a pretty strong, I don't know about dyed-in-the-wool, but strong free marketer. How do you get the bounty of the free market without the destructive capacity of the environmental destruction? So how do you think about that balance?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think there are tremendous virtues of capitalism. I think everything is about balance. And a pure capitalist system is not one that will necessarily protect us against pandemic, and it is not one that will necessarily protect the environment. That does not mean that the right answer is some non-capitalist system. It means that you need a public sector that protects, just as we have a private sector that creates. And if we're worried about protecting the natural ecosystems, we need to have a public sector that views that as clearly one of its jobs and that it takes steps to do that.
On the show last week, we discussed that NASA imagery showed that air pollution in China fell so much during their COVID-19 lockdown that many, many more lives will be saved from cleaner air than will be lost, directly at least, from COVID-19. So how do you think about trade-offs like that? What does that suggest for policy going forward?
Well, if we think that there are that many lives that'll be saved by reductions in Chinese air pollution, then we are at a very bad place in terms of the policy ex ante. I was in India in December, and I was amazed by the deterioration in air quality in and around Delhi for the last 3 or 4 years. Again, you know, it's important that we recognize that horrendous air quality that firms pollute is not fundamentally an indictment of the capitalist system. It's an indictment of a government that doesn't protect people from the excesses of the capitalist system. And we really do need robust policies that stop firms from overly polluting. I think most appropriately is a straight-out pollution tax. But if you can't implement that, then other Clean Air Act type policies are necessary. But if that many lives are going to be saved, then we really need to redouble our efforts as a planet to try and reduce the pollution that costs lives.
Let me ask you one more question about cities and pandemics. You've spoken about a number of downsides. In fact, as someone who happens to live in New York City, they seem like a lot of downsides. So thank you for emphasizing those. But what are the advantages to being in a city, even during a pandemic?
So you have hospitals, you have healthcare providers. I mean, one of the issues with Milan's hospitals right now is they're currently filled with people who got sick in outlying areas and then had to move to Milan to be taken care of. So the fact that cities have these sort of large pieces of health-related infrastructure is clearly an asset. The fact that there are lots of smaller providers, so nimble healthcare clinics that can take care of things quickly, providers for food or other forms of services. So right now, suburban life looks relatively good relative to high-density urban living during the height of the pandemic. What if we now see a storm on top of it? What if all of a sudden, you know, large numbers of eastern suburbs start losing their electricity? It's one thing to be involved in lockdown if you actually can get all the electronics to work. If all the electronics cease working, it becomes a much worse story.
Well, if that happens, I've got a spare cot somewhere for anybody that needs to migrate to New York who's willing to put up with all the downsides of the city. And that goes for you and your family if you can squeeze in a cot. So you're welcome here.
Thank you, Stephen.
Coming up after the break, Even before COVID-19, the idea of universal basic income had gained some traction in America. We'll look into the history of that movement.
Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country.
And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, you can find our podcast on any app, also at freakonomics.com, where we also publish transcripts, show notes, and more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Atlassian. Whether it's providing a single source of truth for thousands of employees or managing projects from start to finish, Atlassian works to unleash the potential of all types of teams with collaboration software. More at Atlassian.com. And by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The idea of routinely sending a check to nearly every American, a universal basic income, it's usually called, was a key feature of Andrew Yang's recent presidential campaign. His prescription was for $1,000 a month per person, and he called it a freedom dividend.
We tested a bunch of names, and then when you had the word freedom in it, then all of a sudden testing shot up among self-identified conservatives. They like hated universal basic income, hated prosperity dividend, all of a sudden freedom dividend. It's like ding, ding, ding.
But the general idea is in fact not at all new. In the late 18th century, founding father Thomas Paine argued for a substantial universal payout based on our collective share of the Earth's natural resources. It didn't happen. In the 1940s, the economists George Stigler and Milton Friedman helped put another version into play. It was called a negative income tax. It was meant to support people in grave need. Here's the economist Evelyn Forget.
So the idea was that if you had no income from any other source, you'd receive a certain level of income, a sort of socially agreed upon level.
Forget is an economist at the University of Manitoba.
And as your income from other sources, and in particular from the labor market, increased, your benefit would decline, but it would decline less than proportionately.
And here is Milton Friedman, in his usual direct style, explaining what he saw as the benefits of the idea.
The proposal for a negative income tax is a proposal to help poor people by giving them money, which is what they need, rather than as now, by requiring them to come before a governmental official, detail all their assets and their liabilities, and be told that you may spend X dollars on rent, Y dollars on food, etc., and then be given a handout.
The hope was that a negative income tax would streamline the burgeoning welfare system without diluting the incentive to work as much as the existing system did.
Our present welfare programs, our present direct relief, and aid to dependent children programs, in effect, have a 100% tax rate. Because if a family on relief, if let's say a woman, as currently is mostly the case under aid to dependent children, if a woman who is on relief takes a job and earns $100, and she's honest, she is required to have her relief payment reduced by $100. That's one of the ways in which we've been producing poor people.
More than 1,000 economists from 125 American universities signed a statement supporting a national system of income guarantees and supplements. The idea had support from many quarters, like the staunch libertarian Friedrich Hayek.
I have no objection against a flat minimum secure to everybody who cannot earn enough in the market.
To civil rights leader Martin Luther King.
That is a great deal that the society can and must do if the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs. Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country.
In 1968, the Republican president-elect Richard Nixon appointed as his urban affairs counselor Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the liberal sociologist and future Democratic senator who was intensely focused on race and poverty. They created what came to be called the Family Assistance Plan.
What I am proposing is that the federal government build a foundation under the income of every American family with dependent children that cannot care for itself. and wherever in America that family may live.
The Family Assistance Plan was sent to Congress. If it got through, it wouldn't be a guaranteed universal income, but rather a floor under incomes for poor families. Nixon was very, very careful to draw this distinction.
This national floor under incomes for working or dependent families is not a guaranteed income. Under the guaranteed income proposal, everyone would be assured a minimum income, regardless of how much he was capable of earning, regardless of what his need was, regardless of whether or not he was willing to work. A guaranteed income would undermine the incentive to work. The family assistance plan that I propose increases the incentive to work.
But was this balance possible? To find out, the federal government had begun a series of experiments.
The purpose of all of these experiments was to look at the labor market outcomes.
Evelyn Forget again.
The big concern everybody had at the time was, you know, if you give people money for nothing, why won't they just quit their jobs?
Starting in 1968, the federal government ran a series of four negative tax experiments in different parts of the country with different demographics. Low-income urban couples, rural families, black households, especially those headed by single women. Selection was randomized, which meant there was always a control group. This is thought to be the first time the U.S. government used this kind of experimentation to measure the effects of a policy idea. Granted, it would be many years before they'd have the data, and Nixon's family assistance plan was still making its way through the political channels. Soon, a similar experiment was happening in Canada.
First year economics class at Glendon College in Toronto. And my professor came in and started to talk about this wonderful experiment that he said was being conducted way out west somewhere. And it was going to revolutionize the way we delivered social programs.
Evelyn Forget points out that the U.S. movement had a conservative thrust, with Milton Friedman advocating for smaller government. But Canada was different.
In Canada, the support tended to come from the left. It was a sort of social democratic impulse, and most of the rhetoric was in terms of social justice.
It was called a MINCOM experiment, as in minimum income. It was conducted in just a couple places, including a town of about 12,000 called Dauphin. It's in Manitoba, a few hours northwest of Winnipeg.
Dauphin was a small town like a lot of other small towns in Canada. It was very dependent on agriculture. There was nothing unique about it, and that's what made it such an interesting saturation site.
A saturation site, meaning that every person who met the income eligibility was offered the deal. In Dauphin, that meant about 30% of the town.
If your income falls below a certain level, you'll receive so much. And as your income increases, your benefit will be reduced. The nice thing about the guaranteed annual income, because people get to keep a portion of their benefits as they go out to work, is that this becomes a supplement for the working poor as well, and there's an encouragement to work.
So in the mid to late 1970s, if you were unlucky enough to be poor but lucky enough to live in Dauphin, Manitoba, you would be eligible for a check from the government. Forget says that a family of four would get the equivalent of roughly 15,000 current U.S. dollars a year. This was in lieu of any existing welfare benefits.
And it wasn't enough to give people a comfortable life. When we interviewed a number of the participants, one of the participants had this lovely line that it was enough to add some cream to the coffee.
That said, the Canadian government spent millions of dollars on the project, but for a good cause, right? To find out if it could support its low-income citizens without killing the incentive to work. So, did the MINCOM experiment work well enough to be turned into policy? What did the data show?
No one ever wrote a final report. There was no more money forthcoming to do an evaluation of the project, and it just disappeared.
Uh-oh. Between an economic downturn and political upheaval, the Canadian MINCOM project lost its mojo.
The researchers were told to archive the data for future research. And effectively what they did was to empty the file cabinets and put all the paper into cardboard boxes.
A Back in the States, things weren't going much better. The Nixon-Moynihan Family Assistance Plan had died in Congress. The right thought it was too expensive. The left thought it wasn't generous enough. Ultimately, however, there were at least two direct legacies of the plan which are still around today. Supplemental security income, which increased federal support for the elderly, blind, and disabled, and the earned income tax credit, which is a small negative income tax, although not a guaranteed income. By now, the political momentum for some kind of universal guaranteed income had greatly diminished, no matter what the data might have to say about whether such a thing could actually work. But what did the data say? The American experiments were still ongoing, and the final analysis was still way down the road. In Canada, remember, the data had been packed up in cardboard boxes.
I finally did track it down.
That's Evelyn Forget again.
A few years ago, I was doing a lot of work on the relationship between poverty and health outcomes. And I remembered this old experiment, and I wondered if I could find any link to health outcomes and to quality of life for the participants.
It took a while, but she found the boxes of data.
I found 1,800 of them in a warehouse in Winnipeg under the authority of the National Archives. But, I mean, I was literally looking at 1,800 boxes full of really badly organized data. No one had ever constructed a database, and no analysis had been done.
She thought about going through the boxes and building a database.
And I sort of realized that my life was finite, and I wasn't going to be able to do anything with that particular data.
But thinking about the Mincom experiment in Dauphin did give Forget an idea.
One of the defining features of this period in Canada was that this was the period when universal health insurance was introduced. And one of the unanticipated consequences of universal health insurance is that you collect quite a lot of data on individuals.
And those data had been sorted and digitized, data on education, employment, and of course, health. So what if Forget could look in these data for people who lived in Dauphin and who presumably got that extra government money, and then compared them to other low-income people in other towns who didn't get that Mincom boost?
And I was able to find everybody who was living in Dauphin during that particular period. So the first thing I did was to look at hospitalization rates, and I found that hospitalization rates had fallen by about 8.5% for the test group in Dauphin relative to the match control group.
Okay, so it looked like the Mincom recipients were healthier. What else did Forget find in the data?
One of the findings was that high school completion rates had increased. And we discovered fairly quickly that boys in particular in low-income families had been under a fair amount of pressure to become self-supporting as quickly as they could. When Mincom came along, some of the families decided that they could allow their sons to stay in high school just a little bit longer. So instead of quitting school at age 16 and getting their first full-time job, these boys stayed in school until they were 18, until they graduated from high school, and took their first full-time job a little bit later.
So in the raw data, it might look like employment fell since a bunch of 16 and 17-year-old boys were not joining the workforce. But in fact, this was good news since they were staying in school, presumably setting themselves up for a better work life. But what about employment among grown-ups? That's the big concern of any guaranteed income plan. Did they stop working once they started getting a government check?
Grown-up people with full-time jobs don't actually reduce the number of hours they work by very much.
One exception, women, especially those who wanted more time off after having a baby.
At the time, I think the legal entitlement was 4 weeks. And it's sort of interesting because as a society, we've already decided that longer parental leaves are something that we want to support. So they effectively anticipated that policy change.
So the effects of the Canadian Mincom experiment seem to be pretty positive. Now, keep in mind, the dollars to do this have to come from somewhere, new taxes or cuts in entitlements or other services. That, of course, is going to be a major part of any discussion about any guaranteed income plan. But the data seemed to show that the biggest concern that everyone would just quit their jobs did not happen, at least in the Canadian experiment. Now, what about the U.S. experiments?
In general, the finding was that primary earners really don't reduce the number of hours they work very much when you offer a guaranteed annual income. It's secondary earners and tertiary earners, that is, second adult incomes and the incomes of adolescents, that fall a little bit.
Very similar to the Canadian results. So there, too, the news was pretty good, although there was something troubling in the U.S. data.
When the findings started to come in, it looked like the families that were receiving a guaranteed annual income might in fact have a higher divorce rate. And this became very political very quickly. In the U.S., there were all kinds of concerns that this was an attack on the American family.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a champion of the guaranteed income idea, was also a champion of the nuclear family. The divorce findings led him to withdraw his support. But Evelyn Forget says that when the data were examined more carefully over time, the divorce controversy seems to have been overblown.
There was a subsequent work about a decade later which suggested that it might have been a statistical anomaly.
So the evidence from these experiments, as narrow as it may be, seems to suggest that a guaranteed income can produce positive results. The funding and the politics are, of course, separate and large questions, but one reason the idea has gained momentum lately is that the world has changed a lot since those experiments. Our economies have changed a lot. There's already been wage stagnation, technological disruption keeps on coming, all of which makes at least one economist, Evelyn Forget, think that the timing is right.
I do see a fundamental and ongoing change in the way the labor market operates, and I do think that we need to make some fundamental changes in the way we deliver social programs. I think a guaranteed annual income could do a very nice job of addressing some of these issues.
Coming up after the break, the psychologist Angela Duckworth on how to best deal with the people you are shut in with.
So I'm not a great role model for this.
We'll be right back.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And by TransferWise, a new way to send and receive money internationally. More than 6 million people and businesses in 70 countries use TransferWise. More at TransferWise.com or on the app.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
More and more government and public health officials are calling for Americans to distance themselves from others, to stay home, to limit any non-essential interactions. This means a lot of us will be spending more time at home with families, partners, roommates, often in close quarters. What will be the long-term results of all this indoor clustering? There are already plenty of theories. A baby boom 9 months hence. A massive decrease in workplace sexual harassment since so many workplaces are closing. Perhaps an increase in domestic violence. Angela Duckworth is a psychology professor and researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. She also wrote the book Grit. Over the past few months, she and I have been recording a series of Q&As for a new podcast we plan to launch soon. One topic that came up recently struck me as particularly relevant in the era of COVID-19 lockdowns. So here's my question.
Yeah.
Does familiarity breed contempt, as the old saying goes? And assuming the answer is at least sometimes it does, which I'm guessing is probably a correct answer, what can you do about it? Because here's the thing. It seems a real paradox that we become contemptuous of the people whom we have the most familiarity with, which would tend to be family,
yeah,
friends, people we work with, because contempt is something that I don't want in those relationships. So it's always struck me as a kind of flaw in human relations, if that's indeed the case. You'd think it'd be better to have contempt for people you didn't know. So if it's true, what are some coping mechanisms so that I can feel warmth and kindness and forgiveness, et cetera, toward the people that I am closest with?
Yeah. Yeah. You want less contempt in your life, it sounds
well,
like.
Well, I'm happy to have contempt for people who are contemptible.
Okay. But not your loved ones,
well,
for example,
presumably,
or just close relations.
My loved ones are people that I don't want to feel contempt for. In fact, I've read literature that says the single biggest indicator of a failing marriage is a high level of contempt.
Contempt. It's John Gottman, right? The
right.
Very famous marriage psychologist calls it one of the four dark horsemen of divorce.
Mm.
There are three others, of course. One is criticism Another is defensiveness, and then finally stonewalling. But I think Gottman has said that contempt is actually the number, as you pointed out, it really is the harbinger of the end of a relationship. I mean, first let's start with what contempt is, right? So we all know it's a negative emotion, but it's different from anger. So when I'm in a fight with, you know, my husband, I can feel angry toward him, right? I could also feel misunderstood. I can feel like he hasn't been fair in our conversation. But contempt is different. Contempt is actually very close to the emotion of disgust. You're looking down on someone, right?
So it's a judgment. It's not necessarily a moral judgment. It could be an intellectual judgment,
etc. Could be, right. I mean, it's got to be one of the most negative emotions you can feel about another person. So I do think that familiarity can breed contempt. And there is some pretty respectable scientific research by Mike Norton at Harvard and others about circumstances under which the more you get to know something or someone, the more contemptuous you feel.
Because you see the flaws?
Yeah, because, you know, when you first get to know someone or something, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity. And so contempt really suggests a kind of certainty that, like, I know who you are. And I don't like it, right? And actually, there's this opposing process that's very well established in social science, you know, the familiarity effect. When you show people little graphic images, like little nonsense characters, the more they see something, the more they like it. You know, it's just completely random, but people like things that are familiar. So familiarity doesn't always breed contempt.
By the way, we should say familiarity breeds contempt. The idea sort of originated with an Aesop fable, the fox and the lion, but it got reinterpreted into the modern aphorism. But here's the thing. You can certainly feel contemptuous toward people you don't know.
But do you think that it ever reaches the level of contempt that you might have with somebody you do know when things are really falling apart? I don't know. Maybe.
Okay, so let me ask you this. How much of contempt do you think is reflective? In other words, I'm ultimately disgusted or upset with something
myself?
In myself.
Oh.
And the reason I project it onto this person is because I can feel them judging me.
Judging me. Yeah. I mean, I think there's some quote, I can't remember what it is, but it's something like, can only see the flaws in other people that you feel about yourself. Mm. I think that the more useful question might be, because I think we all know what it feels like to feel contempt. And I think most of us don't like the feeling of contempt, especially when it comes to our friendships, our family, our romantic relationships. If you're trying to not have this dark horseman on your doorstep, and what can you do? And, you know, I think so much of life is where you pay attention. And the fact is that human attention is extraordinarily limited. In other words, we cannot pay attention
to
everything.
Sorry, what'd you say? I was thinking about something else.
See, there you go. That's true, though. Your mind can wander. So, for example, when you're having a conversation with your spouse, you can pay attention to those little peccadilloes, those little, like, rough edges that you obsess about and, like, well, there you go again. And that bias of attention can lead to more contempt. But if you do the opposite, if you deliberately try to pay attention to the times where your spouse was funny or affectionate or understanding, or, you know, I like this exercise, the three blessings. You go to bed and you think of three good things. You could do a version of that with your relationships where you think, like, what are three things I liked about our interactions today? And that biases you in the opposite direction.
So what would you say would be the most tangible advice for someone who's feeling contempt and doesn't want to feel contempt because they value the familiarity? Maybe it's a sibling, maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's your own kid. Let's say it's someone you really admire at work. You think they're very smart, they're very devoted, but they
maybe you're going to vote different ways this fall, right? I think actually this is a relevant question right now because I don't know if there's a contempt meter, but it's got to be at all-time highs in this country because there's contempt on the left for the right and there's contempt on the right for the left. So what's the recommendation there? You know, I think the most important thing to do is to have humility. Humility is recognizing that you could be incomplete or wrong. Very hard to do. And so trying to recognize that and trying to take another person perspective, maybe the most straightforward thing to do, in addition to, you know, paying attention to all things you do like about this person who irritates you in other ways, is to actually just have a real conversation
about the thing causing the contempt.
Yeah, I mean, if you can, right? If you can do this without things, you know, spiraling out of control, if you can have an argument or you can have a discussion,
right? So I could say that, you know, I have to tell you that when you talk about this issue in this way, it makes me feel contemptuous because I feel very differently.
And mocking my recommendation?
No, I'm really trying.
But yes, if you can do that earnestly ironically.
That was as earnest as I get.
Is that it?
That was maximum,
wow. Okay.
I was maximizing my earnestness and you didn't weren't buying.
But look, I'm not very good at this. I actually had lunch with somebody recently.
Of whom you were deeply contemptuous?
Well, you know, we were friends, and I use the past tense because, you know, talk got to politics, and I left in the middle of the meal, and I haven't spoken to them since. So I'm not a great role model for this.
Did you really walk out during the meal?
I did. I'm not sure I'm proud of that.
Did you storm out?
Like, I mean, I paid the bill first.
Oh.
Does that help? I paid the bill.
And it's not about the money, but it's about you consciously and deliberately. Well, it was obvious that you left.
I said out loud, like, I can't sit here with you. I think maybe we're not supposed to, I don't think we're going to be friends anymore.
It's funny because that,
can I just say it's not admirable? I'm not proud of it.
Is it uncommon for you to do that kind of thing?
That was the only time actually I can remember in my life that I have like walked out.
It's just so paradoxical to me though, that if you think about interpersonal relationships generally, the cliches are we kind of fear the stranger, right?
Yeah.
We fear the person we don't know. We're contemptuous of the people we know the best. So it seems like the answer is just to have a bunch of casual acquaintances to whom you can't really feel anything terrible. Is that the solution?
I don't think so. You know, here's one idea that I heard. There's some politician who was trying to get two sides of the room to agree, and he very strategically made everybody eat first. So everybody had to have dinner together. And it was very hard to feel the kind of contempt and the distance for when you've really broken bread. So, you know, maybe if we could all go out for a kind of like all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yeah, but you're telling us that you stormed out the meal right after you'd eaten.
That's true. It didn't really work for us.
It didn't work for you.
Maybe it doesn't work every time.
Yeah,
I'm an extreme case.
You sure you're a psychologist then, huh?
Yeah. I should probably make up. I don't know. I'm thinking about it.
All right. So let's say you're in a relationship with someone, and rather than being the contempt giver, you're the contempt receiver. You can feel, or maybe they've even told you.
You're on the receiving end of contempt.
Your partner feels contemptuous toward you. So A, what do you do? But B, here's what I really want to know. Don't you want to ask the other person, what is it that's causing you to feel this? And can I do something about it? First of all, I want to know if it's a legitimate, you know, is it a misunderstanding?
Yeah.
And if it's not, then maybe we could talk it out. Because one feature of contempt, it strikes me, is that there's a little bit of a veil of secrecy over
it. It's maybe not out in the open. Right. Yeah. Well, I think you just answered your own question. Well done. because, you know, if you're on the receiving end of contempt, that is surely what you should do, right? Like, why? Every behavior has a reason, right? And if you're on the receiving end of contempt, it doesn't mean that that person is exactly right, but there has to be a reason why they have that contempt. And I think the challenge, though, is, Stephen, if you were on the receiving end of a storm of contempt, would you say, well, what I hear you saying is that you think I'm an awful person. Do I have that right? Like, can you tell me more? What is it that I've done? And I'm really listening.
I know you're trying to make fun of that, but that actually sounds to me better than the alternative, which is usually, is something wrong? Is something bothering you? Did I do something to offend you? It almost sounds better if we're talking about a radical candor idea to say, I feel as if you feel contemptuous toward me right now.
Yeah.
And
no,
it's
I don't
not
mean it to be mocking. I think you're right. Yeah.
It doesn't feel good to feel contempt toward me.
Yeah.
And I would really like to know what's causing it and if I can do anything about it.
I don't mean to, you know, say this sarcastic, like, yes, that is the right thing. But you know what? I'm just acknowledging that in the emotional grip of a relationship crisis like that, not many of us are enlightened enough to do that. And that is why I think there is therapy. I think that is why people go to couples counseling, because, you know, they could, in theory, have these conversations on their own, but they need a professional third party to guide them through what they probably know they ought to do. What you learn in couples therapy is how to communicate, you know, especially under stressful or like antagonistic circumstances. Like, I recently had dinner with a newlywed couple.
Did you storm out on them too?
I decided to not only stay till the end of dinner, but to maintain our friendship. And I was really happy when they told me that they were already in couples therapy. And I kind of gently asked whether everything was going okay. I was like, wow, the honeymoon is barely over. And they had the idea, even when they were dating, to start couples therapy because they were like, oh, it sounded to us that what couples therapy is that you learn a lot of skills about how to, you know, have a relationship. And that sounded good. So we started. And I was like, wow, you're so much smarter than me.
Couples therapy.
Prophylactic couples therapy.
It's a good bumper sticker.
Yeah, it's got a ring to it.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. If you want to be among the first to hear when we launch this new podcast with Angela Duckworth, subscribe to our email list at freakonomics.com. You can also find our entire podcast archive there, along with show notes and transcripts of every episode. As always, thank you for listening.